Welcome to CFRI Cystic Fibrosis Community Voices, a video podcast series created by and for the cystic fibrosis community.
Hello, and welcome to CFRI's CF Community Voices, coming to you from our home studio in Palo Alto, California. I'm Sue Landgraf, Executive Director of Cystic Fibrosis Research Incorporated, CFRI, and I'm very pleased to welcome our viewers and listeners. We have a very special program ahead, but before getting started, I want to thank our generous sponsors, Vertex Pharmaceuticals, Chiesa USA, Gilead Sciences, Genentech, and Proteostasis Therapeutics. I also would like to note that no information presented in this podcast is intended for a patient's diagnosis or treatment. We hope you enjoyed the podcast. Thank you, and let's get started.
So I am a, as we just heard, I'm a pediatric pulmonologist. I'm also a microbiologist, a basic science microbiologist. And I'm also a clinical microbiologist. I really have three jobs. I take care of people with CF and a variety of other chronic lung diseases and acute lung diseases as well. I have a basic microbiology laboratory at the University of Washington, and I also manage a national resource center on behalf of the Cystic Fibrosis Foundation called the Center for CF Microbiology. We provide consultation, actually that brings me to my disclosure slide. We provide consultation and laboratory services to people and companies who are designing studies of CF. And so that's the reason I have these disclosures. But it also brings me to the following slide. In each one of those domains, as a clinician and a basic and a clinical microbiologist, I talk about sputum. Sputum is the topic of the day every day in my life. And I thought I'd put this up as a trigger warning for anybody. I doubt there's anybody in this audience who doesn't talk about sputum frequently. But just in case you find the word disgusting, I thought I'd let you know. Sputum is our stock in trade in each one of these jobs. We get it all day, every day, from the people who we take care of, and even the people who give it to us tell us they don't really like it. The people in my laboratory will tell you that they don't like it very much either. So I figure it's my job in the next 50 minutes or so to try to explain to you why anybody would dedicate their career to studying sputum. And of course, the short answer is because it comes from people with the kinds of diseases like CF that I care about and that I take care of. And lung disease, as we heard, luckily for me, Dr. Clancy gave us an amazing introduction to a lot of the topics I was going to try to summarize. But lung disease is the most severe problem in most people with cystic fibrosis. And of course, lung disease is partly related to infections. Infections are one of the key drivers of lung disease in people with CF. And we know that in part because antibiotics are a cornerstone of care. Antibiotics help to make people with CF better and related infections as well. But the problem is that they certainly do not cure these infections. They don't halt the disease. So many of us look at this situation and say, well, we certainly would like to do a whole lot better. And so that's the reason for the research that I do and many other people in my field. And so with that in mind and that spirit, I decided not to make this a listing or a comprehensive talk about all of CF microbiology and an accounting of all of the bugs that infect people with CF, or a listing of all of the drugs that are out there or that are on their way. But I decided to make this more of a conceptual talk about what we, or at least I, and many of us in the field understand now about why the airways of people with cystic fibrosis become infected in the first place, how we use our usual laboratory tools to diagnose and study these CF lung infections and choose treatments for them as well, and how new approaches, which I and many others are working on, have really pulled back the curtain a little bit and shown us exactly why antibiotics do work or don't work when they don't, and how these findings show us a new way to try to move forward and do better with the drugs that we do have. So I'll start with what we understand about how airways become infected. And to consider that, I think it's really helpful to consider how airways stay clean in the absence of diseases like CF. So, and this, as I say here, this is really the short version of a very complicated mechanism here. We all inhale, CF or not, tens and sometimes hundreds of thousands of liters of air a day, as well as all of the stuff that's suspended in that air that includes pollen and other particles and bacteria and microbes. Tons and tons of, well, that's not true. Lots and lots of microbes, not tons. And when we inhale those, a lot of those particles then deposit on the upper airway walls. This is the nasopharynx and the oropharynx. They filter out a lot of these microbes, but they also have a lot of microbes themselves, so they contribute some to that air column. And those microbes continue to deposit as they go down through the lower airways and into the lungs. Very, very few of these particles actually make it into the lung tissue itself. And so the airways really filter out most of them. The airways also produce, as we've heard about a lot, a very thin layer, usually, of mucus. It's a gel whose job, if you want to talk that way, is to collect all the stuff that we inhale and then serve as a vehicle to allow us to move that stuff out. And we have a bunch of mechanisms, again, as we heard about, usually to move that stuff out. We have cough, which all of us do. We have immune functions like white blood cells that can clear out some of the stuff. And then we heard again in Dr. Clancy's talk this morning about cilia, which beat up. These are these microscopic projections on epithelial cells that beat up and move this column of mucus laden with stuff up and into our mouths. And then most of us, without even knowing it during the day, just clear our throat and swallow that stuff very frequently. And so that's how we keep our airways clean. The problem with CF and some other related diseases, of course, is that these mechanisms just don't work. There are actually problems in each one of these domains. Cough doesn't work as well as it should. White blood cells don't work as well as they should. And cilia don't work as well as they should. And so as a result, as shown in this incredibly high resolution photograph here, it's a schematic of a cutaway of a healthy airway or an airway without CF or other clearance defects. As you can see, or can't see, and indicated by this arrow here, there's a very thin layer of mucus in the healthy airway. And then in CF, the mucus is just too sticky to be moved out, and so it builds up. And as a result, this mucus, which has trapped all of the stuff that people have inhaled, turns out to be a great location for very specific microbes to thrive. Some microbes don't, and some do. And so this environment selects for very specific microbes. And what you end up with, as we heard about again this morning, are cycles of infection, and then inflammation as a result of that infection, as well as obstruction. And the inflammation ultimately leads to scarring. And that's what's supposed to be shown by these thickened walls compared to the absence of CF. And also dilation of the airways. And as we heard about this morning, a word we use for dilation of the airways is bronchiectasis. This is what we're trying to avoid, and I think we're doing a pretty good job in CF. This is a cutaway, a single slice of a CT scan of somebody with CF, and you shouldn't be able to see in healthy lung, as you do over here, you shouldn't be able to see any airways, but here are bronchiectatic airways. This is the end result, this is very late stage disease, of this cycle of infection and inflammation. The correlates of this pathophysiologic model, though, are that the infection in CF is in the mucus. It's different from most infections that we as clinicians and microbiologists and infectious disease specialists think about. It's really localized, not in the human body, not in the tissues, but rather in this gel. It doesn't invade tissues, so it doesn't really get into the body under most conditions. So it's really different from usual infections. Another characteristic that's really different from usual infections is that we can't eradicate it. It just persists despite very exuberant inflammation and even aggressive antibiotic treatment. We, as you know, can use antibiotics to knock it down, but we rarely ever knock it out with very, very rare exceptions. And these, as I mentioned, are unlike a lot of the infections that we pay attention to. And I wanted to tell you what I mean by those infections. And I think it's helpful to describe what I mean by classical infections here by talking about a little bit of history here, which I suspect a lot of people know. The dawn of medical microbiology really began in the 1800s, modern medical microbiology, as a result of efforts of a lot of people, men and women, but of course there are two men who got their faces on the cover of that magazine, a German named Robert Koch and a Frenchman named Louis Pasteur, but of course many other people helped. And the result of the efforts of these people was a set of tools and concepts starting in the mid-1800s and continuing for the last 100 years or so that have been incredibly powerful in allowing mankind to conquer some of the scariest infections that have and scourges or plagues that afflicted mankind. And in general, those infections were the kinds of infections that rapidly killed people. They involved a new organism infecting somebody who'd never had it before, and that organism would grow quickly and kill somebody quickly. So this is what those tools were really designed for. And the idea behind these tools then was to isolate that pathogen that caused the disease and use these laboratory tools they developed to isolate that organism, grow it in the laboratory, tease it apart, find out what kills it. And using these methods, as I mentioned, mankind really conquered some of the scariest diseases ever to afflict us. And they were very successful. In general, the infections that it works for are infections, as I mentioned, involving a new pathogen getting into a place that was previously sterile. So examples are cerebrospinal fluid in the head, in meningitis, the blood in sepsis, the epithelial lining fluid in the lung tissue, that's pneumonia, urinary tract infections. These generally involve a new pathogen getting into a sterile space and growing very rapidly in a liquid. And in general, then, the laboratory techniques that were developed to study them involve isolating an organism and growing them suspended in a well-aerated, rich liquid, just like they would be in the body. And in general, therefore, those laboratory techniques really reflect the behavior of these acute, rapid infections. And in general, antibiotics work very well against these rapidly growing organisms, both in the test tube and in the body. So these are great tools for those kinds of infections. But as I'm alluding to, a little more dramatically than I need to, I think, is that we're left with a set of infections, like CF, that just don't behave according to those rules. And we call these the chronic infections, or many of us do, with their defining characteristic being that they don't respond to antibiotics and they don't get better according the way that they do in the test tube. They just don't behave according to the rules of these tools that we have. And in fact, they just sort of putter along. They progress along over years and years. And in the process, as you scale up over all of mankind and human history and all of the people who suffer from chronic infections right now, they cause tremendous amounts of tissue damage and suffering and fortunately, sometimes early death, despite our best efforts with antibiotics that our tools tell us should work. And as you are probably thinking of other kinds of infections, or you may, there are going to be a couple of gross pictures up here, by the way, another trigger warning. But chronic infections afflict essentially every part of the human body, particularly those that are not sterile. And almost everything that we put on or in people can become chronically infected again as well. Again, with the defining characteristic being that they're not rapidly damaging, they're slow, and antibiotics don't work very well against them. But of course, being a pulmonologist, these are the kinds of infections that I care the most about and that I study. Chronic airways infections, which generally involve the failure or inability to clear microbes from the airways. And these two are actually a couple of patients who I've taken care of. This is a stock picture you can find on Google Images. But the point is, there are a lot of different chronic lung infections that behave like CF, but CF is relatively well studied and of course, very important to me. And the point I'm trying to make is that everything I'm gonna tell you about has implications for all kinds of chronic infections, airways and not. And in fact, CF is one of the paradigms that many people use to study all kinds of chronic infections. So it turns out this state of affairs has been noticed since the earliest days of CF literature. And this is just, I have a couple of motivational quotes that I keep on my wall. I have a lot of them actually, but these are two of the CF ones that I love the most. This was a phrase written by two of the earliest pioneers in describing CF disease in children with CF, Paul de Saint-Agnisi and Dorothy Anderson, pathologists in New York, who wrote in one of their earliest papers about children with CF, where they noticed that they all had infections, and the infections looked the same to them, and they would treat them with antibiotics, and some of these kids would get better, and some of them wouldn't, and they were trying to explain how they were going to fix this problem, try to understand why some people did not respond. What they basically said is, we will be able to understand why some people get better and some don't when we can understand why they get infected in the first place, and we can understand why some people are sicker than others, which is a very circular argument if you think about it. They're basically saying, we don't understand much here. And it does motivate me quite a bit. I'm glad to say that we've come a long way, but it just shows goes to show you the state of affairs in CF. And I've got another quote in a second that'll summarize this even better. And so that brings me to my next topic, how we use these tools that I talked to you about, these traditional tools that we've adapted for chronic infections, how we use them to study CF. So in general, we take the stuff that our patients give us, we then streak them out or inoculate them in a laboratory medium, and those media we've chosen already to select out the organisms that we already think are the most important ones. And I'm going to be a little deliberately provocative here. So we take a few isolates, and then we let those cultures grow up, and we take a few isolates of those traditional pathogens, and then we reculture them. This is one isolate that was swabbed on this whole plate here, and these are antibiotic impregnated strips. And you can see the zone of clearing that shows us that this bug is particularly sensitive to these six antibiotics. So based on these laboratory susceptibilities of a few isolates of our selected pathogens, we then diagnose our infections and we choose antibiotics to treat our patients and hope for the best. And as I mentioned, sometimes it works and sometimes it doesn't. So let's consider just how well these tools do work. And by the way, I need to mention at this point, I'm not trying to depress you. I'm going to show you a way forward at the end of all of this. And it's important for you to know that the laboratories that I run still use these techniques. We're just trying to do better. So let's consider how these tools work in diagnosing CF infections first. So this is a slide you may have seen. Most CF microbiology talks begin with a slide like this. It's put out by the CF Patient Registry every year, the Cystic Fibrosis Foundation Patient Registry, and it shows you the proportion of patients in the United States during a single year, and these are the most recently published data, who were culture positive for six traditional pathogen species. These are the ones that we pay the most attention to and we direct our treatment towards, as broken down by age. And I just wanted to point out two of the most commonly detected organisms, which you may have heard of. We've heard a little bit about them today, because I'm going to talk about them in a minute. There's this bug, Staphylococcus aureus, which is particularly common in children, becomes a little less common as people get older. And then Pseudomonas aeruginosa, which is much less common in children and becomes more common as people get older. Okay? And there are some others there as well. This is another way to look at the data, which the foundation has just started putting out as well, this type of slide, which I find very helpful. Instead of showing you how these prevalences change with age, these actually just show you how the overall population prevalence has changed over the past 17 years in the United States, according to our data. Just another way of looking at the data. And it shows you that, for example, the ecology has really changed. The detection of Staph aureus has really increased in recent years, and that of Pseudomonas has gone down. So that Staph, at least about 10 years ago, 12 years ago, became the most common organism that we detect in people with CF. So these are the traditional pathogens. This is the depiction we get from traditional cultures of CF infections. And just in case you were wondering, this is another maxim that comes from traditional culture methods. This is what I was taught all the way up until my early faculty career, through medical and graduate school, et cetera. This is just one example of a phrase that's peppered throughout the literature up until about 10 years ago. And it says that in the absence of significant disease, our standard methods tell us that the healthy human airway, airway without CF or other similar diseases, is sterile. So that's what we knew. And that's the depiction of infection that we get from traditional methods. Now let's consider just how well these methods work in helping us to figure out what is making our loved ones and patients with CF sick and what makes them better. So a number of studies have looked for very good relationships between the antibiotics we choose based on these methods and whether a patient's going to get better with those antibiotics, and have not been able to find any good relationship. Put differently, our methods do not allow us to reliably select antibiotics that are going to help make our patients better. In addition, again, I'm not trying to depress you, and I am being deliberately provocative. There, a number of studies have looked for a good relationship between how abundant these organisms are, their density in sputum or other secretions from our CF patients, and how sick they are. So for example, you might expect that as Pseudomonas becomes more abundant, somebody would be sicker, or as it goes down, they might get better, and have not been able to find any good relationship either. Plenty of people have very high abundances of these organisms and are not sick, and vice versa. And just to make matters even more frustrating for those of us who take care of children with CF, several studies have shown us that a good fraction of children with CF, about 1 in 5, who come to the hospital sick enough to need antibiotics, have completely negative cultures for traditional pathogens, which makes it very hard to know how we're supposed to treat these children and make them better. So, as I mentioned, many of us in the field look at this situation and say, we've got to do better. This is not good enough. And that is the motivation behind the studies, some of the studies and information I'm going to tell you about. We're trying to improve. And it also, this kind of situation is the was the motivation for my second favorite illustrative or motivating illustrative quote in CF by Dr. Ephraim Racker in 1985, reviewing some CF literature. You may have seen this before, it's famous, who said, anyone who reviews the literature on CF and isn't confused is confused. And that's how I and many others felt about 15 years ago as these data started to become available and decided to try to do better. So there are a lot of reasons, we've heard of some of them today, a lot of reasons why there may be this disconnect between our microbiological findings and clinical outcomes. And one of them is a very, I think, a real possibility, or likely. And that's that infection is just part of the problem here. As Dr. Clancy showed us, infection is just one leg of a 3- or 4-legged stool, depending on how you look at it, that contributes to CF lung disease, involving obstruction of the airways with mucus, inflammation, and infection feeding into both of those. And that is true. But because I'm a microbiologist, and because this is about bugs and drugs, and because I'm so proud of my title, I'm just going to focus on the title of the talk, that is. I'm just going to focus on infection. So let's just consider infection for the next whatever's left over. Another possibility is that, as I've been alluding to, our current detection methods do not accurately reflect the way the microbes behave in the airway, in sputum, and it doesn't really reflect the diversity of those microbes in those secretions. And as it turns out, there is good evidence that both of those are true. There's emerging evidence, for example, that our aerobic, well-aerated, suspended, rich medium cultures don't really reflect how microbes behave in mucus. And one of them, which you probably heard about, and I think there have been questions about it, involves biofilm formation. We know now that a lot of microbes in many chronic infections, like CF, don't infect as suspended or free-swimming or free-floating microbes, but rather they're adherent, either to each other, as they seem to be in this electron micrograph from my colleague Pradeep Singh, who showed clusters of Pseudomonas in CF sputum. And then it's been shown even more, I think, elegantly by a group at Caltech just this year, Diane Newman's group, who showed us clusters again, these small microaggregates of Pseudomonas and Staph aureus and some other organisms in CF sputum. So this seems to be the preferred growth phenotype behavior of microbes in chronic infections. And these are very resistant to antibiotics and they tend to grow slowly. Another characteristic that's really not well modeled includes nutrients and oxygen. So just as a really good example, this group in Germany a number of years ago, 15 years ago, Dieter Wörlich and Gerd Döring did a very simple experiment where they put oxygen detection probes, microprobes, in the airways of, inside the airways, of people who are undergoing bronchoscopies with CF. And there's plenty of oxygen, even in really damaged airways, they showed. But the second you put that probe just a few microns below the surface of a mucus plug, the oxygen is almost undetectable. And the point is, this is just one example of how nutrients can be limited compared to the culture conditions that we use in the laboratory. We are not accurately modeling these conditions. And under both of these conditions, in biofilms, in limitation of these particular molecules, bacteria just and other microbes don't grow well. And antibiotics don't work like they do in suspended liquid cultures. In addition, because they grow poorly, we might not be detecting certain organisms when we go to the laboratory. And that brings me to my second point. So clinical microtechniques that we use don't reflect their behavior, but they also may not identify all the organisms that are there. And that includes traditional pathogens, as well as other microbes that we aren't even looking for. Some of them, for example, that just grow slowly and are tough to culture with our usual methods, or those that we're just not looking for. As I mentioned, we use selective culture methods that only look for our traditional pathogens. So to summarize what I've shown you so far, our classical or traditional methods do not accurately reflect the composition of CF infections in terms of which bugs are there. Some of them aren't detected well or at all. They don't reflect their behavior very well. They grow differently in sputum than they do in a test tube. They don't reflect their response to antibiotics, and we know that from clinical data. And they just the starkest example of that is that they persist despite using antibiotics that our tools tell us should work. And so in the rest of this talk, I just want to give you a couple of examples. And as I mentioned, I'm not trying to be comprehensive. I'm just trying to show you how some laboratory studies have shown us exactly these principles, but also opened the door to trying to do better. And some of these data are from our laboratory and some are from other laboratories, but the point was just to try to give you examples. And the first one is going to be about a traditional pathogen called Staph aureus small colony variants, not because it's the most important, but because it exemplifies these principles. And then I'm going to talk to you about a new set of methods that many of us are using called microbiome methods. So let's talk about small colony variants first. This is a story of mutants of Staphylococcus that tend to emerge during chronic infections, and they are called, this says, by the way, whatever it is, it's very, very little. I should be reading these to you, I think. This is really a story about how we might be missing even important versions of traditional pathogens using our current methods. So as I showed you before, Staphylococcus, this gram-positive bacterium, is the most common organism in people with CF right now, that we detect anyway. And I also wanted to point out that the foundation also collects information on subtypes of these traditional pathogens. This is methicillin-resistant Staph aureus. We also had a question about this before. And this is just one flavor of Staph aureus that happens to be resistant to one particular antibiotic. There is also multi-drug-resistant Pseudomonas. So we do care about subtypes. But there's another subtype of Staph aureus called small colony variants, which the foundation does not yet collect information on, and I think it'll be clear in a second why. And they are so called because they just form small colonies when they grow on laboratory agar media compared to their normal, usual wild-type brethren. And they do that because they grow slowly on most rich laboratory media. They grow so slowly, their colonies tend to be about tenfold smaller than the usual ones. This is not terribly important. And they only grow slowly in the laboratory, as far as we know. They might grow okay in people. The problem is that they have mutations that make them unable to make very specific molecules or nutrients that they need. And so, as an example, there's a culture of this small colony variant swabbed on this whole plate. These are discs impregnated with a variety of different nutrients. And here's one nutrient that makes the small colony variant grow. This guy is deficient for producing this particular molecule, thymidine, and when you give it to the bug, it grows okay. And this is actually the most common type of small colony variant that we see in CF. So these guys tend to emerge. Very few clinical laboratories, however, use the advanced culture techniques or prolonged cultures that it takes to identify these guys. Not a lot of people are convinced that it's important yet. And I agree with them. So not many labs look for them. Many labs in Europe do, in Germany, almost everybody does, Switzerland, almost everybody. In the US, there are a few. And we are one of them, which is why I'm gonna tell you the results of our study. The same mutations that make them grow slowly also make them highly resistant to a lot of antibiotics for the reasons that I mentioned before, at least in the test tube. And they emerge in a lot of different kinds of chronic infections, with CF being one. And the reason that we got interested in this topic was because early in my faculty career, our laboratory did some experiments that showed that small colony variants tend to be selected by a lot of the characteristics that are really common in the airways of people with CF. And they include, for example, antibiotics can select for small colony variants. The presence of other bacteria like Pseudomonas also strongly select for small colony variants. So the implication is that over time, as staph in the airway encounters these selective forces, these influences, eventually you would expect small colony variants to emerge in a lot of people. But the problem is we wouldn't know because we don't detect them very well, and they're resistant to a lot of the antibiotics that we use to treat our patients. So it raised the question of whether staph is there as a small colony variant much more often than we realize because we're not detecting it. And it turned out that around that time and before that, there had been some studies from Europe that sort of supported this. These studies showed that if you looked in CF patients cross-sectionally, that you could find about 20% on average, 25% of people with CF have them at any particular time. And the people that have small colony variants in those studies tended to have lower lung function and to be older. And so that could be concerning. It sort of fit the model, and it also raised the possibility that they're important. So we decided to look a number of years ago in just our local CF population. This is not a study we could at that point do nationally because, again, very few labs look for them. But luckily, our laboratory had already started looking. This is before I actually started running it. So we wondered, how common are small colony variants in a US population, in our kids? And if they are common, are they associated with better or worse outcomes? Are they important for our patients? So we did a 2-year study of 100 of our local children with CF at Seattle Children's Hospital. And we collected all of their staph, including all the small colony variants we could detect, and clinical characteristics to see whether they were sicker or less sick. And to make a long story short, we found the same kind of prevalence that was found in Europe, in Germany, in Switzerland, and even Turkey. About a quarter of these kids were culture positive for small colony variants during the study. And again, these probably would not have been detected in many other places. But we became even more interested, which is a metaphor or is a euphemism for concerned, when we saw that when we compared the kids who did versus did not have small colony variants during the study in terms of lung function. This is forced expiratory volume in 1 second, FEV 1% predicted. In the kids who were old enough to do lung function testing, the kids with and without tended to be about the same age on average. But they had lower lung function at the beginning of the study, 80 versus 100% predicted on average. And more concerning, they lost more lung function during that 2-year study. They lost about 8% of their lung function on average compared to 1.8%. Now here's the kicker, and this is a common problem in CF microbiological studies. Small colony variants, we know, are selected by antibiotics and by other bugs. So whether the small colony variants were the cause for this change or a marker for it, we don't know. That is, for example, patients who were sicker to begin with and just get a lot more antibiotics might get more small colony variants because they get more antibiotics. So this is always the problem in our CF microbiology studies. We can't easily detect or figure out from observational studies whether a particular microbe is the cause of a change or just reflects that change. And this is our challenge. But I'll show you in a minute how we try to get around this. So to summarize this study, small colony variants are common among our local patients. And I have to add that based on these results, we now have an ongoing multi-center study in the United States that's showing very similar prevalences. The results will be coming in the next year to see whether they have the same clinical associations as we found before. And they're either important pathogens or they're markers of a more advanced disease, and we want to know which. There are also some studies from Europe that have come out that have, again, supported these findings. However, before we start to freak out and start treating people for these, we really want to know whether treating small colony variants make patients better. That's the real question. And so I would say, watch this space. Tune in. We will be working on this and promise to get back to you soon. And this, again, is just one example of one kind of bug that we're not detecting that may be important, but many of us are working on this problem. So as I said, standard laboratory techniques don't identify everything in chronic infections like CF, and that includes traditional pathogens and also some other bugs that are difficult to culture, and that includes small colony variants, for example. There are also examples with other kinds of bugs. For example, there are subtypes of Pseudomonas that are difficult to identify. And since there are subtypes of even the guys we're looking for that we can't identify using usual methods, one example is nontuberculous mycobacteria, very hard to find, and we only detect it some of the time we know it's there. If we're not detecting the stuff we are looking for, what else are we missing? Are there other bugs we don't even know are there? And that turns out to be exactly the problem, a problem that was faced by a parallel field in the late 1900s called environmental microbiology, who invented a set of techniques called microbiome methods. And in this, the problem that they were having is summarized really nicely by a very elegant phrase, the great plate count anomaly. What these very clever scientists and engineers had noticed in environmental microbiology is that if they took a sample of soil or water or pond scum or coral, and then counted the number of viable bacterial cells or microbial cells under the microscope using stains, they could tell they were alive, and then tried to culture that same sample with the best techniques they had, there was always at least a 100-fold difference. They could only detect about 1% of the cells they knew were in that sample that should be able to be cultured. And they made that observation repeatedly. And that was the motivation behind developing these new techniques, which you may have heard of, called microbiome methods, where instead of having to culture these cells, they would identify them using DNA signatures. By taking a sample, and this is an example of, this is a microbial mat on the surface of a geyser in Yellowstone, pretty nice job, I would say. Extract all of the DNA from that sample, and then use a variety of different methods to just focus on the microbial portions of that DNA, the signatures, and identify and enumerate and quantify and classify and characterize the microbes in that sample without having to grow it. And using these methods, they've been enormously successful in allowing this field to identify a lot of microbes we otherwise wouldn't know are there, and we still don't know how to culture in the laboratory. And it was only a matter of time before people looked at the success and said, I wonder if this is happening in people too. And that was the motivation behind a set of experiments, which you may have heard of, called the Human Microbiome Project in the United States. There are parallel efforts in other countries. And the goal of this project was to, again, enumerate, classify, characterize all the microbes in and on healthy people, and then eventually see how that changes with disease. And since these efforts began in the early 2000s, at a time when we knew that the human airway was sterile, the lung was left off. So I'm foreshadowing a little bit. I think that was a little short-sighted. And you may have heard of the wild success of the Human Microbiome Project. We have learned a tremendous amount about all of the bugs that live on and in us and their role in disease and in health in recent years. It's been reported in the popular literature. But it turns out that the microbiome studies of CF really began before that success was starting, thanks to a couple of very clever environmental microbiologists in London who just happened to know a pediatric pulmonologist. Let me see. How am I doing on time? Am I good? Okay. Named Geraint Rogers and Ken Bruce, who happened to know a pediatric pulmonologist in London, and they talked about this issue and thought, well, this problem in CF looks an awful lot like what we're seeing in our soil samples. So I wonder what will happen if we study a bunch of CF sputum samples from adults using our now state-of-the-art microbiome method. And sure enough, they identified plenty of traditional pathogens using those methods, the same guys that we could culture, but at similar abundances, a lot of microbes that are not cultured. And since then, it took a while for the world to notice, but since then, there have now been literally dozens and dozens of studies. And in bold, I am just cheekily identifying the very few studies that I've been fortunate to be involved in. But the point is, this is an incomplete list. There have now been lots and lots of studies that have confirmed and extended and clarified these results. And basically, what we know at this point, number one, after dozens of studies and hundreds of children and adults with CF, is that regardless of the specimen type we take from people with CF, we can identify very diverse microbes in their sputum or in their samples. And that includes not just the typical CF pathogens, which we can identify with culture, but a lot of microbes that we could culture, but we generally either ignore or select against because we thought they came from the mouth. We call them oral flora. And a lot of microbes that we don't look for and don't culture. And most of those are called anaerobes. They grow in the absence of oxygen. And just as an example of how hard it is to ignore these data, this is actually a culture-based study from a group in Belfast in Northern Ireland who looked at the aggregate abundance of Pseudomonas in all of these CF samples. The abundance is on the y-axis. And the white bars show you Pseudomonas in all of these samples. And then in gray is the aggregate abundance of all of the anaerobes in each one of those samples. It's very hard to ignore just how abundant these guys are. Now, you remember, well, it was only a matter of time before people looked at that these results in CF and started to apply them to other kinds of diseases, and even people with asthma, people who smoke, and really, again, found a lot of microbes. And people started to wonder, well, I wonder what happens in the healthy human airway. You remember what I told you about what we knew from culture? Well, a number of years ago, and again, repeatedly, we found that our concept of the healthy human airway being sterile turns out not to be right. We can detect microbes very, very often in the airways of people who have no known disease. And at low concentrations, we don't know whether they live there all the time or whether they're just constantly being delivered and removed. But the point is, they're there. It's not sterile. And so this has really changed the way we think about the human airway, and it led to the model that I gave you at the beginning. And it also led to some very interesting studies to compare how these microbes, how microbiology differs in different diseases, because it can tell us something about what's specific to disease, different diseases, and how we should be treating them, either similarly or differently. And then again, this is not an incredibly informative study I'm about to tell you about. I've just got two more studies. But it gives you an idea of how we can use these methods to try to move forward. So this is a small study that we published a number of years ago where we took the lavage fluid and sputum from children with CF, some children with a related disease called non-CF bronchiectasis, which is basically chronic infection for reasons other than CF, and then from kids who had another kind of disease, just this one's treatable, or more easily treatable, called protracted bacterial bronchitis, which many of us have probably had. This is a chronic wet cough that only goes away if you have a good long course of antibiotics. And so we compared the microbiomes of the most common organism in the microbiomes of kids with all three of these types of diseases. And what we found, I'm just showing you the simplest measure of how similar they are. This is a similarity measure. It shows you how similar these microbes are, the microbiology was, between kids with these three diseases. Here's bronchiectasis, protracted bacterial bronchitis, and CF. And this 0.9 means that these were all 90% similar to each other. 10 minutes. Or are you giving me a score? Did I get a 10? I got a 10. Yeah, I think I'm within that. And the point is that at these early stages of disease, even when they're symptomatic, kids with all three of these kinds of infections had really similar microbiology. It wasn't specific to their particular disease. And in fact, the microbes that we found often in these guys, we also happened to find in people without any known lung infections, kids who happened to be undergoing a bronchoscopy. So the point is, it seems like these infections just start from inhaling the usual stuff that all of us inhale. But a really interesting picture emerged when we looked at the adult versions of the chronic diseases, CF and bronchiectasis. And here we found that not only did the adult versions differ, they were somewhere around 50% similar to their pediatric versions, but they were also less than 50% similar to each other, which is really interesting and confusing, but hopefully really helpful. The point is that while these infections start similarly, they diverge over time in a disease-specific way. But there are a lot of things that differ. The people's diseases differ in the way they manifest. We also treat them with different drugs and different treatments. So we don't know if microbiology is a cause or a reflection of these disease manifestations, the same problem I told you about before. Whether microbes cause the disease and differences in the diseases, or whether we're doing it by treating them differently and driving microbiology differently. And this is a key question in trying to understand how to go better, do better. So for the final research story I want to tell you about, I just want to define a term I'm going to use loosely here called diversity, which I think we all understand. It is basically a term that just talks about variation in something. And in this particular case, I'm talking about variation in how in microbiology. But there are really two terms that this concept encompasses. One of them is just richness, which is the number of taxa, the number of species in a particular sample. So for example, if you've got 10 species, your richness score is 10 in a sputum sample. But it also encompasses the concept of evenness, which is how those species are distributed. As an example, if somebody has 10 species, but Pseudomonas has 90% of the cells, that is an uneven community. But if there are 10 species and each makes up 10%, that's a very even community. Both of those concepts are important in measures of diversity. And what we've learned now, based on, after 15 years almost of microbiome research at CF, is that diversity in sputum goes down as patients get older. The diversity decreases as patients get older. That decrease in diversity, and here's the measure that we use most often, that includes both evenness and richness, that diversity also correlates with advancing disease. And this, by the way, is not our study. This is a really nice study from Toronto that that made some figures that I think project particularly well and make my point. So diversity correlates with increasing age, with advanced disease. It also correlates with increasing antibiotic exposure. As people get more antibiotics, the diversity in their mucus goes down, and it correlates with increasing dominance by traditional pathogens like Pseudomonas. The problem in trying to understand what is causing what is the same as before. All of these characteristics correlate with each other. As patients get older, they tend to have worse lung function, they tend to have had more antibiotics, they tend to have more dominance by traditional pathogens. So we don't know if microbiology is causing disease, if antibiotics are driving microbiology because the people were sicker to start with. Very, very important questions. But there is a way forward, and that is to try to understand what happens as we treat the disease, as we perturb things by adding a new treatment. And one of them is CFTR modulators, which Dr. Clancy just talked to us about quite a bit. So many of us are studying what happens as people go on to ivacaftor and other CFTR modulators. And in particular, does Pseudomonas become less dominant or other traditional pathogens? Does diversity increase? Or put differently, as people get better, do we turn back the clock so that sputum microbiology reflects earlier stages of disease? That is what we hope for. And so we did, the last story I'm going to tell you about is, again, a small study that was just published a few weeks ago, where we studied the sputum microbiology of adults who were taking ivacaftor. And we just heard about it, so I'll leave out the main details. But the point is, a limited fraction of CF patients benefit quite a bit from this drug. And it's been approved for these people by the FDA. And so, 5 minutes. Oh, my score went down. So we wondered then what would happen to sputum microbiology as people start on ivacaftor, both within a week and within years. And in either case, we wondered whether the abundance of traditional pathogens like Pseudomonas would change, whether the abundance of all bacteria would change, do they clear more bacteria, and does something happen to diversity? And most importantly, if there are changes, does that correlate with how much better people get? Does that tell us something about causality or pathophysiology here? So we studied 12 adults at a single center in Dublin, led by Ed McCone, the PI of this project, 8 of whom had Pseudomonas. Again, a really small study, and it was a pilot study, but the results were so powerful, they did get published very quickly. And we collected sputum before, within a week, and up to 3 years after starting on ivacaftor. And we used a combination of usual and microbiome methods to study their microbiology. So let's look at what happened to the microbiology. And again, this is still the Reader's Digest version. So what we found in the 8 people who had Pseudomonas is that, yeah, the density of Pseudomonas, both using, this is a microbiome method, but culture showed us the same thing. Pseudomonas actually decreased very rapidly within a week and continued to decrease throughout the entire study. But the same was true for all bacteria. All bacteria were cleared, again, within a week, the whole study. And this was true even for patients who didn't have Pseudomonas. So it wasn't due to a specific effect on one particular bug. But something really interesting emerged when we put these two curves next to each other for the people who just had Pseudomonas, these 8 people. The decrease in Pseudomonas was faster than it was for the other bacteria, as if there's a particularly marked effect on specific organisms, which is something we're really interested in understanding. And the consequence of this, the fact that some dominant organisms got cleared faster than others, increased the evenness. And that means that diversity increased during the study as well. My point is, Yes, sputum microbiology regressed. It resembled much earlier stages of disease. Even during this, even within the first week, it looked like we'd turned back the clock. And when we looked at the relationship between these changes and some clinical measures, there were a lot of correlations. The patients who got the most better had the biggest increase in diversity by many measures, and also the biggest decrease in all bacteria. So these improvements, the microbiological improvements, seem to have a good tight relationship with clinical improvement, and it supports a good relationship between microbiology and lung disease, which is something, again, that we want to study. But one word of caution at the end of this in interpreting these results, this finding here, which is something we're going back to, you may notice that, again, this is a really small study, 2 minutes, there seemed to be a rebound at the end that we're going to have to go back and look at, and we're going to try to clarify this, and we wonder what it means. There are a lot of reasons. It could be there, and I'm happy to talk about them, but watch this space as well. So that is why we study sputum. What we found is that CF lung disease behaves like all other chronic infections. It's polymicrobial. Our laboratory tools that we usually use don't reflect its behavior, and it doesn't respond to antibiotics like we want to. We want to do better. And I hope I've shown you a couple of examples of how we are developing new culture-based and culture-independent methods that help us get a much richer and more nuanced depiction of how these infections occur and how they behave, and hopefully a way forward to trying to understand how to treat these patients better, because we're not doing well enough and the infections are not going away immediately. So in the next few years, I hope you'll see more accurate studies about how antibiotics work and what goes wrong when they don't. More accurate studies about what happens when people start on the miraculous new therapies that are coming through, and hopefully much better treatments for the infections that are making our patients sick. So in case you are skeptical, as I was at the outset of the microbiome era, that these methods are really detecting something important, I wanted to leave you just with a thought experiment that a very wise colleague of mine, John LaPuma, at the University of Michigan suggested. He said, think about what our list of traditional pathogens would look like if these guys had invented microbiome methods first. What would we think of the important bugs? And I think that's really helpful. And so with that, again, I thank you very much for your time. I thank everybody who has participated in any study that we've, or anybody else, has done to try to understand how to do better here. There are a lot of names on this slide. I forgot to include Ed McCone in Dublin on here. And here is a picture of my laboratory at our last Christmas party. And with that, I'm happy to take any questions, if I have time. Thanks, everyone.
Thank you, Dr. Hoffman. Okay, we do have time for some questions here. Do want to remind you, limit your questions to one per person because we are limited on time. And when asking a question, speaking into the microphone and let the volunteer clean it between uses. Thanks.
So it seems like lately in the news you read about the ability for bacteria, especially Pseudomonas, to kind of form this quorum, and it can kind of communicate and then know to grow fast. Do you?
Yeah, so I think what you're talking about is a behavior that a lot of gram-negative bacteria have, well, a lot of bacteria, actually gram-positives too, called quorum sensing, where they secrete hormones and other bacteria can detect those hormones, and it turns on specific behaviors only when they get to be at a particular density. And that does appear to be a really important behavior for acute infections. What's really interesting is that we and many others found a number of years ago that for Pseudomonas and some other bacteria in chronic infections, they tend to mutate that system away. And that turns out to be, it appears to change quorum sensing behavior quite a bit. And we don't know exactly what it means yet. It certainly changes quorum sensing and the communication between bacteria. I'm not sure it completely eliminates it. But the point is that a lot of the work that was done early on using laboratory strains of Pseudomonas and staph probably don't apply to behavior in the lung. This is another example of how the laboratory techniques probably don't reflect true behavior. I do think it's probably an important behavior at the beginning of an infection, establishing an infection, but ultimately I think it becomes dispensable for the bacteria. And it's a very important system in regulating antibiotic resistance and regulating response to the immune system in sticking to each other and to surfaces. But exactly the role it plays in cystic fibrosis, I think the jury is still out. Does that answer your question? Okay. Thanks for the question.
Do you know, has anyone ever tried to create a culture medium similar to mucus in CF lungs?
That is a very good question. And yeah, I'm embarrassed I didn't think to mention this. There is a medium another clever researcher, environmental microbiologist named Marvin Whiteley invented a number of years ago called synthetic CF sputum medium. There are actually a couple of them. And it's made really to reflect the composition of very specific molecules, amino acids and ions and some other molecules. And in the intervening years, a lot of us have added things to it, like mucus itself, DNA, which we know is really abundant in sputum. Problem is, we're not so sure that composition is how similar it is between patients. And there are a lot of things that the human body makes, including the airway, that we don't know how to measure. So the behaviors of even just Pseudomonas in synthetic sputum medium are not identical to what you see in sputum. Another attempt has been to actually take sputum, dry it out, and then reconstitute it in a growth medium, and that also has some benefits and some it works in some ways and not as well in other ways. So it's not perfect, and that's something that's evolving, something that we'd really like. At this point, sputum is sputum, and we don't yet have a sputum 2.0. Thanks for the question.
Hi, thank you so much. It's been very informative.
Good.
This is kind of a shorthand or a weird way of thinking about it, but I suppose if a person with CF is still culturing a diversity of infections, they're healthier than maybe if they are not. And then, so I would like for you to speak to that. And then I don't understand, is there anything being done about the whole concept of biofilm? Thank you.
Yeah, both very good questions. So in terms of diversity, a lot of the work is showing us that diversity tends to increase in babies over time in their respiratory secretions, and then it tends to decrease as patients get sicker and older, which is pretty much what you said. So there's a period when there's very little diversity in babies early on, and then they acquire more microbes, and then as time goes on, some of those microbes get pruned away, or they're replaced by other microbes, something like that. And there is a very nice, very tight correlation between diversity in people over the age of infancy and how sick they are, what their lung function is. This has led to, I don't know if you were going in this direction, but this has led to a number of proposals to try to increase the diversity in the sputum of people. I'm a little concerned about just jumping into that, because doing so would involve putting microbes into the airways deliberately of somebody with a disease without knowing for a fact that that's gonna make people better. But that relationship is pretty well established at this point by a lot of research. In terms of biofilms, the real problem is that, again, a lot of the really early work, just like with quorum sensing, a lot of the really early work on biofilms involved bacteria in a rich liquid medium sticking to glass or plastic surfaces and assuming that that reflected the kinds of biofilms you see in mucus, which is really globs of bacteria stuck to each other, not to a surface. And it turns out that a lot of the characteristics of globs are not the same as the characteristics of biofilms growing on surfaces. So the strategies that people were working on to unstick microbes from surfaces don't necessarily work as well on globs, which is what we need to be paying attention to. Some of them do. And you may remember this morning, Dr. Clancy talked to us about some strategies like gallium, which is being investigated, which seems to have some anti-biofilm activity. And also inhaled nitric oxide, which also has some biofilm activity. It seems to disperse biofilms. So just by complete chance, it turns out that we are investigating some anti-biofilm therapies right now, but not because somebody designed them for exactly that reason. The other issue is that while there are a lot of microbes out there that form biofilms, they all do it in a slightly different way, and it makes it really hard to come up with just a global anti-biofilm therapeutic. But there's something that we think about quite a bit. Yeah. Thanks for the question.
So I missed your talk. I was in the other room. So sorry if you already
talked
about this.
It's okay. I'll give it again. Here.
I asked earlier in the pipeline talk about drugs targeting MRSA, and he mentioned a phase 2-1. And I think he said to ask you about it. I kind of forget. But can you talk a little bit about what's going on to fight drug resistance?
Yeah. So that I actually don't know anything about results, and I'm very sorry. I'm happy to talk to you later about how to find those results when they become available. I can point you in the right direction, and I'm embarrassed I didn't put my email on this talk. I should have, but I'm happy to give it out to people. That study, I think that Dr. Clancy was referring to is about Aerovanc, which is aerosolized vancomycin, which is a drug that in theory is effective against any flavor of Staphylococcus. We talked about a couple subtypes, and MRSA is one of them. The initial phase 1 results were reassuring, and I'm hoping that it works. But I don't know, and I should mention, by the way, there was also a study that was published last year led by the University of North Carolina on strategies for eradicating methicillin-resistant Staph aureus colonization at either early or even persistent stages. And it was fairly effective, I have to say. It's not an easy strategy. What I would add to all of this is something that I talked about in my talk, and that is that showing that you can eradicate something is not the same as showing that it makes somebody better. So this is something that I watch very carefully. I am glad we know how to eradicate MRSA. I'm waiting for results showing that that people actually get better when you take it away. And the same goes for Pseudomonas. I think eradicating Pseudomonas, I think we're starting to see that it makes a big difference. For MRSA, it clearly has infection control and quality of life implications. The way that somebody is cohorted and treated in the clinic, the access that people get in the hospital is different if they have MRSA versus not. And that's a good enough reason, I think. But I also really want to know whether people are going to be less sick when we get rid of it. So I'm happy to point out the website for Aerovanc, so you know when those data become available. And I'm also happy to point out the study by Marianne Mulebach on the STAR-2 trial, which was eradication of MRSA, if you'd like. Did I talk too long? Oh, I get one more question. Yay!
I don't know if this is your expertise or not, but why don't some people with CF not produce productive with coughing or mucus after treatments? Why, and what do we do to make that happen?
Boy, is that a really interesting question. For those of us who study sputum, I think I professed my love for it pretty profoundly here today. I take it personally when they can't give me a sample. No, it's actually a really good sign, I think, that they're not able to produce sputum. I don't know. And I have to say, it doesn't seem to be directly related to microbiology. I think that's really interesting. People with Pseudomonas don't necessarily expectorate. They tend to. People with non-tuberculous mycobacteria don't always expectorate. They tend to, but not always. And I think that's I think it's really interesting. There are protocols that the CF Foundation, the Therapeutics Development Network, have developed for inducing sputum with hypertonic saline that in some places has been really helpful and really effective. In our hands, it doesn't work in everybody. I think that's probably the case in most places. But I guess the two questions you're asking are, what does it mean and what do we do about it? For the what does it mean, I don't know, but I think it's a good sign. I actually think it's a sign that since expectoration is becoming a little less common anecdotally among our pediatric population, I think it means we're doing better, or they're doing better, I hope. And number two, what do we do about it? We really just have, inducing sputum as one option. We tend to do oropharyngeal swabs as a not very good surrogate. I didn't talk about that today. and we can do bronchoalveolar lavages, which I'm not crazy about because they involve sedation and they're not very fun to do for the patients. So at the end of the day, and this is the dirty little secret that I was trying to pull back the curtain on, I don't know how much it matters. I want to know what bugs each individual patient has, but since I believe I hope I just showed you that culture doesn't show us everything that's there anyway, I don't know that we really need to sedate everybody to get a good lavage sample, because I know that that our culture is not going to show us everything anyway. What matters the most to me is finding something that's going to make somebody better, and our cultures may not be required for that. Okay, thanks.